Yeah. Thank you, Rick. Thank you. Thank you, Ray. No.
Yeah, thank you, Ray.
Thank you, Ray. Thank you. To our great Vice President, Hubert Humphrey and Muriel, to Senator and Abigail McCarthy, Governor Rolvog and Florence, Lieutenant Governor Keith, Marion, Congressman Blatnick, Don and Arvon Fraser, and distinguished guests and fellow Democrats. It is true, as the Vice President reported, that we conducted a poll at the head table to determine when this esteemed speaker's program would conclude. And I can tell by the look in your eyes, you're really anxious to know. Now, we find there's a basic split between those who tend to speak and those who tend to listen as follows. Congressman Fraser bet 950. I bet, give him a big hand. I bet 10-15 because I'm still a junior senator. Senator McCarthy, who's going to give the speech, bet 10-10. Hubert Humphrey, who first asked if Muriel was going to get a chance to speak, bet 10-30. Muriel bet 11:40 and Florence 12 o'clock. Seriously, I am most grateful that Congressman Blatnick was thoughtful enough to recognize Warren Spanis here tonight. I know that this event could not have been a success without the efforts of literally hundreds of you here tonight. But I know that Warren has personally put in just an unbelievable and heroic several weeks of effort to make this not the event he described it yesterday, but in fact, ladies and gentlemen, the most successful, the largest amount we've ever raised at a DFL fundraiser in the history of this political party. To the Republicans, we can tell them we have no more debts, the ledgers are clean, we've got a small war chest, and 1968 is going to be a terrible year for the Republicans. And this could not have been the case unless those of you here tonight had given substantially to this event. And this is hard to express, but I don't know of anything more frustrating than trying to conduct a campaign or a political party which is in debt or does not have enough money to tell its story. We can have able candidates, we can have fine people working at the local level, and from time to time, we will win elections. But in modern campaigns, it is the case, sometimes regrettably, that we must have enough money on hand to tell our story effectively and to pay the cost, the sometimes excessively high cost of modern media. And those of you here tonight who saw this need and who went the extra effort to raise money and to contribute your own money mean more to the strength and the vitality, more to the optimistic prospects of this political party than you know. And I join with every office holder and every party leader here to say that we are profoundly grateful for your willingness to sacrifice this money that I know you could use for other purposes and contribute it to this party and toward the fulfillment of your political philosophy. We're going to be a stronger and a better political party because you're that kind of person, and we will be eternally grateful for it. Now, it's my privilege to introduce an Irish politician. Gene McCarthy is a person that I've always regarded, as have you. But this 2.5 years of service with him in the Senate has helped me understand more than ever before the greatness of Senator McCarthy. I have known, as have most of you, of his leadership in our political party here in Minnesota. Not only has he served as a congressional leader for 18 years, but he was one of the original knot of leaders who realized that if we were going to have a liberal movement in Minnesota, this DFL party had to be revitalized and had to become an effective political instrument. He is more than just a political leader, however. He was one of the great spokesmen of this nation. He is strong within the structure of the Senate. He serves in perhaps the two most influential committees of the Senate Finance Committee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and also on a little mentioned committee known as the Steering Committee, which is the most powerful and least discussed committee of all. Gene McCarthy is one of the true powers in the United States Senate today. But his power does not come alone from the positions that he's been awarded, but even more because of the strength and creativity of his mind and the courage of his spirit. Symbolized by his great nomination of Adlai Stevenson, he has been a restless, strong, and outspoken spokesman for the liberal faith. He is truly one of America's great citizens, and I'm proud to introduce our own Eugene J. McCarthy.
My colleague of the Senate, Walter Mondale, Vice President, members of the Congress, state officers and legislators and officers of this party and Democratic Farmer Labor friends. I'm not sure as to just what the state of this party is, but I'm sure that the quality of introductions is on the uprise. Tom Byrne has done nothing more for us. He's set a new standard. And Walter has responded and surpassed him, considering the subject he had to deal with. Only one note of reservation. Reading the program, I noted I was currently serving my second term. I'm the only one mentioned as currently serving. I wasn't quite sure what that meant. It seemed to have a note of a kind of tentativeness about it, but insecurity. I thought I ought to reassure you that my father just celebrated his 92nd birthday. And I've given some thought to his university office, but I went back the other day and read what I said about Harold Stassen when he went from politics to the university. And I just don't think I could bring myself to face my own remarks. Well, this is a party of unity, in diversity. Our meetings have always been that. I thought of Roy Weir one day talking about our party. He said, you know, it's made up of nothing but the city. Well, that's not a bad way to have it, I think. We're open to all the dissidents. Let the prodigal son come back, and if old Enoch Arden is out there looking in the window, well, even he can come in. We'll find a place for him. Usually, these audiences expect me to say some notes in the Republican. I like to oblige that. They just had a big rally in Washington. They had several remarks that recall jokes. They said, brought down the house. I was going to repeat some, but I think it'd be offensive to this audience. They just don't meet any kind of standard that we usually insist upon. They had all their new senators there. And one fellow said, you know, if you took them up a mountain, rolled them up in a ball, and then rolled them down the mountain, there'd be no surprises on top at any time. I think the more we see of them all together, the better it is for the country. The better for the Democrats. Well, a little earlier, there were two State of the Union messages given, one by Gerald Ford, the Republican House leader, and the other by Senator Dirksen, who's their Senate leader. I thought you ought to know what Ford said first. He used to be center on the Michigan football team. That was back in the old days when the first defensive act was to hit the opposing center on the back of the neck. It was a standard practice. This seems to run through, this experience ran through his whole message. He said he was going to meet every issue head on. And he said he was going to take a hard look at every problem. Well, that was about all the offensive center could do. He'd take a hard look at you and then put his head down. And that was the end of his offensive. And then he said that, well, he said something about paradoxes. And I don't think he really knows the difference between a paradox and a mastodon. But it was a good hard try anyway. And went on to take his firm position, as he said, on the dynamic and constructive center. Well, that struck a kind of note of memory in my mind. I checked back to some old notes that I'd made in 1953 when Arthur Larson was the spokesman for the Republican Party. And he said then that the Republicans were standing, he said, firmly astride the authentic American center, grasping the American consensus. Well, that's a rather frightening image, really. You know, But I quote it simply to point out to you that there really hasn't been any change in 14 years. Well, then they brought on their Senate leader, Mr. Dirksen. And he took three firm stands. One for the protective tariff. That was an issue in 1890. Well, then he took a firm stand for the gold standard. That was William Jennings Bryan. That was the issue in that campaign. And then he proposed a tripartite agreement. We weren't sure what that was. We think it's a substitute for the Treaty of Utrecht. Treaty of Utrecht is an issue this year because the Spanish want Gibraltar back and the British took it from them in 1713. And we think the Republicans might be ready to look at that treaty. The only complication is that it would allow a Habsburg, if we repeal it, to sit on the throne of Spain. And that would be a little radical for them, I think. It's a kind of a progressive thing. Finally, Everett took a rather bold stand against Europe. It's a little hard to read this, but this is an exact quotation. He said, "What strange bedfellows have developed in Europe after we have taxed our people to keep them afloat." Well, we didn't know why we were taxing, but we know now what the consequences are. Well, I cite this to really make the point that it would be easy to run against Republicans if that was all we had to do. We could never lose an election. But what we are called upon to do, Democrats and liberals and Democratic farmer laborites in this state, always is really to run either with or against the needs of the country. And to run in the face of what we call the demands of history. This has always been the challenge to us, and with reasonable success, we have responded. But it's been relatively easy, really, for the last 20 years in comparison with the kind of response we're called upon to make today. The issues were not very complicated, and to understand them, we didn't really have to be very bright. The educational needs of this country have been rather clear to most of us, at least since 1948. We saw the need for education, Almost everyone should have seen it. In any case, we didn't have to be particularly intelligent, just a little bit observant to see this need. Medical care for the aged has been, I think, rather an obvious need for at least 20 years. At least to some of us, there were a group of undertakers who testified against it 2 years ago on the grounds that if we passed it, we would disturb the traditional doctor-patient relationship. Well, it wasn't hard to make a judgment against that position. You didn't have to be particularly intelligent or particularly moral, you know, to understand what the cause was. It wasn't hard to see what labor needed and what it deserved, what its rights were, and what farmers needed and what they deserved and what their rights were. And it really didn't take a great deal of intelligence to accept that civil rights were guaranteed under the Constitution of the United States. You didn't have to really be a great student of history or of the Constitution to see that. Oh, we had a few Republicans who looked deeply and thought we ought to guarantee civil rights under the Interstate Commerce Clause, but we thought maybe you could do it with the Constitution itself and the Bill of Rights and one or two amendments that had something to do with it. But relatively clear. The question of the repeal of national origins and the Immigration Act has been an issue since at least 1946. Not very hard to see that this was an insult to practically every nation in the world and an insult to about half of the people in this country. And when things are that clear, it isn't so hard to note that you have a problem and propose some kind of partial remedy at least. And in addition to that, response to these issues didn't really call for a very great moral commitment on our part. Not much intellect, not much judgment, and really not very much character. Because in almost every one of these cases, we could see our own personal benefit. Our children or the children of our friends were going to benefit from education. We could be somewhat selfish about it. Medical care for the aged, a kind of selfish involvement. I mean, you could see somebody you knew was going to benefit from it. And so on down through labor and agriculture, dealing with urban problems, civil rights, and even national origins in the Immigration Act. And after 20 years, we have passed most of these programs successfully, for the most part, in the last two Congresses, the 88th and the 89th. And we do deserve some credit because we had to convince many people in the country to respond and to support us. And I suppose that we must give some credit to Senator Goldwater for having been the candidate in 1964, because he made it clear to the country what many Republicans in the Congress really stood for. And when that was made clear to the people, they voted for Democrats and we were able to pass these programs. But what we did throughout this period was to take minorities, each of which had a special problem, and put them all together in order to accomplish good for each one of those minorities. It was kind of all for one and one for all. Today, the problem we face is that minorities in groups of seven or eight can be put together to vote against the interests of another minority. The old idea, the democratic idea, the morally responsible one of minorities, which is what we are in this nation, accepting the needs and the rights of minorities and voting for them, is being challenged today. This is a time of, I think, the greatest test of this century, of the intelligence of liberals and also of their moral commitment. Because as the Vice President listed for you, the programs of what we call the Great Society, for the most part, are programs for which there are no constituencies. You have to develop a constituency of understanding, and you have to develop a constituency of moral commitment. Because the poor are not all of us anymore, and not very many of us. And so you have to understand their problem and then make a commitment to their problem. The mentally retarded are not a constituency, really, in America today. They're not going to vote in a block. You can't put them together, but you have to reach out to them and say to people who are not mentally retarded, this is your responsibility. The new efforts we're making in the field of civil rights, not the old simple right to vote, but the new ones in the field of housing and community development. No real constituency. They are not a positive and supporting one, but certainly a negative and a critical one. And really, there's not much of a constituency for beautification if you go looking for it. So this, across the board, the challenge to us, to develop, first of all, our own understanding of what these issues are all about, and then to go on from that to make a moral commitment to the achievement of whatever this judgment dictates we must attempt to achieve. Liberals must first understand the problems themselves, then explain them to others, and then, we hope, move them to some kind of action. Well, how do we go about it? First of all, I think we have to redefine, really, the old and basic rights guaranteed by the Constitution. Freedom of speech today really involves much more than what was understood when this was guaranteed in the Constitution of the United States. Because we have to define it and seek to secure it in a world in which most communications are controlled by very few people. And the basic right is not so much that to say what you want to say as the right to hear the truth. And starting from that, we develop processes and procedures and rules so that at least the greatest measure of truth which is available may be given to people for their judgment and for their consideration. Freedom of assembly, guaranteed by the Constitution, was a rather simple right under conditions existing then. But today we have to define it and attempt to exercise it in complicated organizations, in demonstrations, in picketing. All of these a modern manifestation in a complex and highly competitive society of a basic constitutional right simply presented as the right to assemble. The right of privacy in the Constitution simply said you can't quarter troops in a house. But today it involves electronic devices for listening to your most private conversations, electronic devices for spying on people at 100 or 200 or 300 yards and even more. How do we define this right and how do we protect it today? Freedom of religion was relatively clearly understood at the time the Constitution was adopted, but every day it's subject to some kind of challenge, and we faced it well, I think. Oh, we did pass a bill requiring the words "In God We Trust" on the American money. We did it under the Eisenhower administration when we had little confidence in George Humphrey. It was not really a religious test. It was a kind of a political action. We thought it might, you know, stabilize the market or something. But when challenged fundamentally with the Dirksen Amendment in this field, we faced up to it in the Congress, accepting and trying to manifest in action some kind of stand against a challenge to a basic right. Due process of law has become more complicated as we've come to know more about human behavior, as we have more wealth and more means by which criminals can be treated. We cannot accept trial by the police, or trial by the press, or even trial by Congress. Well, redefining all of these ancient rights does require intelligence and study and genuine commitment. Not just in this field that we're challenged. To explain our economy now is much more difficult, partly due to Walter Heller. You know, it used to be you could just talk about the business cycle. There are a lot of people who hate to see it go. I mean, politicians could kind of wait for it to come by on the downswing, and some businessmen had learned how to make money in the recession period, and there were some economists who liked to teach that course every 3 years. It kind of gave an appearance that the science was real, you know, because it happened every 3 or 4 years. They'd say, look, we drew the chart, and there it is. But to explain to the people sometimes why we ought to have a little bit of inflation, it's not altogether immoral, why we perhaps ought to have deficit financing, and even why we have three budgets. waiting for the vice president to explain that earlier today, but we've got a new commission that's going to explain why we have three budgets. But each one is justified, but 10, 20 years ago, there was no problem with three budgets. Nobody really cared very much. This is part of the complexity of politics today. We don't stop just with these old rights and these special problems. We have to define and explain the new civil rights of Americans. Not civil rights in the limited sense of the right to vote and protection of the courts, but basic rights which we now hold belong to every American. The right not just to job equality, but to job opportunity. So that an American can say, I need not be poor. Poverty is not the lot of an American today. He has a civil right, a right which society must give to him if he is to be a good citizen, and a right which society can help him achieve. Education, even though Barry Goldwater said the Constitution says nothing about it, has become a citizen's right and a civil right in America, not just for elementary school students and high school students, but across the board, promising the fullest possible intellectual development to the most talented people in our country, because we need all of their talents and all of their knowledge, but also reaching out and attempting to provide education to those who are least talented and most denied, the retarded and the mentally ill in our society. Each one of them having the right to develop the fullest possibility and the fullest potential of his personality. A third new civil right is the right to a house in a community. This involves both personal and social needs. And the real test comes not when you say, well, it's all right for somebody to vote with me, but when you go beyond that to say, I don't mind voting with him and I don't mind having him live in my community. A civil right to a wholesome environment, relatively free of poisons, asking some safety from the automobile, which is vital to American society today. The right to be free of criminals and to have some protection from ugliness. This, the intellectual commitment which we're called upon to make. But the final test, I think, of the liberal is in the moral field, where we ask that each of us demonstrates right attitudes towards the poor, right attitudes towards the deprived and to the denied, and the right attitude towards those who are underprivileged. We accept that our responsibility now is really not just to humanity or not just to some great bloc or mass in America, but to every person in our society. And this same commitment is called for not only in domestic relations and domestic affairs, but also in our commitments overseas. In understanding with reference to Europe, because we should understand them and they understand us. In patience as we deal with Africa. In helpful trust as we deal with the problems of Latin America. In some kind of prudent but restrained cooperation as we deal with the Russians. It's interesting, we can get agreements, trust the Russians in outer space, but we have some members of the Senate who won't let us have four of them in Cleveland. Test ban treaties, but no consulate in Cleveland, Ohio or Dallas, Texas. But I think we'll place a consulate there and take some chances. And finally, in this same kind of commitment, a moral commitment, to deal in hope with Asia, looking to a day when, by means other than force and violence, we can work out some kind of reconciliation. These are the basic and ultimate tests, not just of liberals, but of human beings in society. To use the best instrument we have available, our reason and our intellect, to understand as best we can, for in no other way can we escape from really the false fear which has been the plague of mankind throughout his recorded history. And secondly, failing of absolute and certain judgment, to be disposed when we are uncertain as to what course we should take, when everything is in balance, to be willing to make mistakes on the side of trust rather than on the side of mistrust, to make mistakes if we must on the side of liberality and generosity rather than on the side of self-seeking and of mistrust, at all times to undertake to be right about the ends and the objectives we seek, and as right as we can with reference to the methods which we use. Never, if we can help it, to do the wrong thing for the right reason, and ever to attempt to avoid what T.S. Eliot called the ultimate treason, to do the right thing for the wrong reason.